Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in Military History. I am Boris Karpa. Today we have with us somebody who is quite an accomplished researcher, has published over 30 articles, has been involved with the Modern War Institute as a visiting fellow, also a veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard. We have Jay Overton, who is here in because he is the editor of, and this is quite a mouthful of a title, Naval Contributions, Sea Power by Other Means, Naval Contributions to National Objectives Beyond Sea Control, Power Projection, and Traditional Service Missions. Welcome to our show, Jay. I hope I didn't miss anything out when I read that.
No, thank you, Boris. You're right. It is a kind of unwieldy subtitle there to get everything in. Exactly. So appreciate it. You got it great.
So, you know, of course, you know, I've read, you know, I always read the books before I, you know, as I prepare for the interview, but most of our audience probably has not read the book yet. And so we can explain it to our audience, to the people who are now following along on their iPhones or whatever. Not all of them have access to the website with the book summaries. Can you tell them a little bit about this book and what it brings to the table and what it is about?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed this podcast for a while. I'll start, since I've had associations with a few U.S. government agencies, by saying all the opinions I'm expressing here on the podcast are mine alone. On to the book. So, yes, it does have a pretty the subtitle is definitely unwieldy, but it's the book itself is an exploration of the things that navies and naval services like Coast Guards and even Marine forces do and have done that falls outside of what they're actually designed and maintained to do. Not just other operations and activities, but operations and activities which actually contribute, sometimes unintentionally, to the objectives or advancement of their respective nations. I started putting this together in 2021. If you think about that year, that's when the U.S. military was, as they still are, preparing for a return to great power competition, and the U.S. Chief of Naval Operations was describing his service's reason for being as, of course, the traditional power projection and sea control mix. But while that's going on, U.S. Navy medical personnel were deployed to the Navajo Reservation in Arizona and New Mexico in the U.S., very far from contested shores or sea lines of communication, to vaccinate Native Americans against COVID-19. And U.S. Navy bases were housing thousands of refugees from Afghanistan, and U.S. Navy ships and aircraft were providing humanitarian assistance to Haiti. That's soft power projection, of course, but it's not really what those platforms were built to do, or necessarily what those sailors and personnel were, you know, thought they were going to be doing when they joined up. At the same time, also there, we're having often tense maritime interactions between the People's Republic of China and the United States. And even then, U.S. naval forces were doing missions like mountaintop search and rescue and still smuggling enforcement and even domestic disaster relief, seemingly unrelated to the early predictions of the return to great power competition. It's not really a new phenomenon, as we argue in the book, or it's certainly not one unique to the U.S. Navy. Throughout history, we've had navies and sea services have spent a significant part of their time and resources doing what the late Samuel Huntington called, quote, a Navy's subordinate and collateral responsibilities, unquote. It's something they do and they might be expected to do, but not what they're provided and maintained to do. Those responsibilities have at times contributed way more to their country's security, prosperity, and identity even than traditional roles. And also at times they may have been done due to just a lack of emphasis on actual fighting and winning wars. Whatever the reasons, they're more, I argue that these activities are more common and persistent than grand battles and great ships, but they just receive far less attention than their frequency merits. So our goal of this book was to highlight some of these overlooked achievements, examine how they might inform current and future naval operations. Perhaps a more accurate title might be Sea Power with Other Means. As I sort of mentioned, I believe that's closer to the original Clausewitz reference. And of course, naval forces can often perform their traditional and non-traditional roles simultaneously. And I also, that I guess I didn't mention there, really wanted, although I'm in the U.S., really wanted this to be as international as possible. So it's put together by a German think tank there, ISPK. We have great contributors from Nigeria, from other countries in Europe, Canada, Australia. We had a retired admiral with the Dominican Republic Navy who expressed interest early on and wrote a really great foreword for us. So it is a very international of looking at what navies do. And of course, we're talking to you across the world right now. So there, a little bit about the book.
And so, you know, as I always say, we on this show, we are creatures of tradition. And, you know, because you know, the title of the book, the subject of the book is somewhat unorthodox. So, you know, the whole idea of naval contributions beyond sea power by other means. It's not a very orthodox title and not a very orthodox subject. And so, I'd like to ask, how did you end up choosing the subject?
Sure, thanks. I'll definitely grant, not very orthodox, and again, I called out right in the subtitle. Yep, not very traditional, but I think, you know, work with me here. I think we'll get to there. I would argue some of these things are actually traditional because they've been going on a while. Perhaps because my air quote naval service was in the U.S. Coast Guard, as mentioned, and even then, when I was in for my 4 years there, so I was at units that don't do what most people think the Coast Guard does. I guess since then, for 30-something years, I've been drawn to lesser-known or unrecognized military history subjects. Even leaving aside most of my own very tactical level experiences, still, most of what militaries do day-to-day isn't necessarily what most people think they do, I would argue. This book came about, really, I'd presented papers at the U.S. Naval Academy's McMullen Naval History Conference a few times before, and those were always sort of, my subjects, my papers were always sort of shoehorned into panels with either other one-off papers where there you couldn't really get them together in much of a group that dealt with some Navy subject beside grand battles. So I thought, there in 2021, I thought I'd see if there was enough interest in getting a panel together that specifically dealt with the very broad subject of this book. I put out a call for papers and really just put the book's title I came up with here and a little bit explanation there, and just thought I would see what I'd get in, putting out calls on SIMSEC, on Society for Military History, on HWAR, HNET. I got really good papers came in from lots of good researchers, established academics, folks still in naval service. And the panel was accepted by the folks at McMullen. And then while I was at McMullen, I met Sebastian Bruns from ISPK, who was teaching at the Naval Academy at the time. And after a little correspondence, he expressed interest in a book on the subject, which I was already sort of seeing if there was enough interest, enough people who would contribute something to that. So the idea of which I was pursuing anyway, there, and we went from there. That's how the book came about in a very short, came about, of course, over the course of a few years, as these things seem to do. But that's the short answer to that.
One of the topics which several of the authors in the book address is, of course, the role of the Navy in diplomacy. And usually people think about these, you know, we sometimes read about these in the papers, these fleet visits, these naval visits to foreign ports. And usually this idea, you know, even people, even the historians, you know, when they talk about these naval visits, and outside the really big and famous ones, outside like a few exceptional events, like the Great White Fleet, but most of these are just sort of, you know, oh, this is some pomp and circumstance the navies of the world do out of politeness. It's not really that important. But that's not true. These visits are actually play some kind of role, which we laymen don't understand.
I'll agree, yes. So
maybe you can educate us a bit. Certainly I didn't know about this, and you know, I'm a naval historian, so if I didn't know, certainly it's something you should maybe clarify to our readers.
Sure. I would argue almost everything in this book on a small d diplomacy has something to do with you're either doing a something to your internal stakeholders there or external outside of your own country. So I would argue almost everything in the book has something to do with diplomacy, even if it's just, you know, rescuing someone from a mountaintop or a flood or something within one's own country. If it's done by the Navy, it's somehow at least, doing community relations, somehow that's fosters good feelings for the Navy. From the book, where it gets quite specific on this, the real expert from her chapter is Dr. Katrina Ponte. She wrote the books. We start out the very first chapter, and probably the one that goes back farthest in time, is called Our Proud Spirited Fellows. And that's about the U.S. Navy's role in diplomacy with South American nations in the early 19th century. This is a time when the U.S. Navy is already global to some extent, but of course it's dwarfed by the navies of Europe's empires. In the time she mentions, it's actually U.S. diplomats traveling aboard U.S. Navy ship to Brazil rather than on a merchant ship. Usually they would travel apparently on just a charter ship, but this time it was decided to send them down on one of the U.S. Navy's nicest, newest warships. She talks about this quite a bit, and they made a big point of making sure that the sailors going down were, I guess, looked a little bit, sailors and Marines on their ship looked a little better than the average sailor or Marine at the time. Just really wanted to put as a very young Republic heir, and they're not just talking to Brazil, really. It's still when you have the Portuguese Empire to some extent, though. So they really want to make a good impression. Dr. Ponte includes her chapter with the quote, "The activities of the South America Commission," which is the group that goes down here, diplomatic mission, encapsulates the uneven application of U.S. foreign policy in the early 19th century and its cultural and political preference for the development of republics in the Western Hemisphere, and by, quote, "serving as cultural surrogates for American national identity." So there she's saying, in some ways, if, you know, when you send a Navy ship abroad, whatever it's doing, it's in some ways, I think, serving as a cultural surrogate for the country it came from. So she says, goes on to say, "Together, the Navy and State Department propelled American foreign relations forward and articulated a cultural vision of republicanism," that's republicanism with the small r, "for the hemisphere," that being the Western Hemisphere. I think the cultural surrogate might, again, be the best holistic description for naval diplomacy. This chapter also deals with Navy and interagency work, and that's a very common theme throughout, particularly in the last chapter, which calls for a maritime department. But again, I think almost everything in there, every chapter in the book, in some ways is going to deal with it. You're going to see a little bit of diplomacy going on there. Thank you.
And just to move on from this a little bit, you know, and this is something which not only the United States Navy does, but, you know, any Navy does this to some extent. Your book discusses the United States Navy and the Royal Navy, but of course other navies have performed other similar roles in the past. You know, in the Messina earthquake in 1908, the Russian Navy famously, you know, if you go to Italy, you will see it. I think it's maybe it might be in Sicily, I don't remember. You will see monuments to the you know, courage of the and benevolence of the Russian sailors who have provided this assistance. So you know, a Navy is, navies traditionally have, you know, a tertiary role. They provide humanitarian relief. You know, sometimes it's actually the ships, which will, you know, the ship, you know, might be somewhere in the ocean, it might be near some place where there's a disaster, there might be, you know, like you describe in the book, your author described in the book. Sometimes the ships will. I'm sorry. I hope you do not hear that.
No, it's fine.
There's some machinery which is working in the background.
Oh, no. That's fine.
But the thing which I'm trying to say is that navies are by their nature set up. They have the facilities, they have the skills where they can provide aid. It's one of their traditional roles, and maybe you can tell us more about this function of navies as the delivery organizations for international aid.
Sure, and that's also mentioned in almost every chapter in the book, in some way of it. A few chapters really hit on it specifically. So ships, of course, can carry more people and material, and usually for cheaper, and carry it farther than about any other form of transportation. So that's I won't say easy mission, but it's one that falls pretty easily within their capabilities. And there's something to the fact that if a ship or an aircraft and its personnel are capable of operating in a contested combat environment, sustaining themselves there with their own logistics, doing so with minimal support infrastructure, then they're already prepared to a great extent to help out after natural disasters. Even if shore-based infrastructure is damaged, an amphibious ship is, or even before those were came about of their own special classes, they were still often able to, bring men and supplies, material, personnel, supplies ashore without, they didn't necessarily need port facilities there. Those were nice, but they could probably do it without those. Plenty more recent experiences of this, the U.S. Navy and other international navies, after the Indonesian earthquake and tsunami in 2004, I believe it was a massive international effort down in that area there, Southeast Asia. Japan's Navy and other navies after the, or Japan's Defense Force and other navies, including the U.S., after the Japanese earthquake of 2011 there. A U.S. Navy, which I'm more familiar with, does many smaller tasks like assisting with flood relief in civilian communities. That happens fairly frequently because if you have a helicopter and crew who can rescue a downed airman or rescue people from a sinking ship, they can probably also do things, within if they're standing by somewhere in the U.S. or either in their shore base or on a ship, they're probably equipped to help out with things going on there. It's not infrequent in the Northwest where I live for Navy search and rescue helicopters rescue civilian hikers stranded in the wilderness of mountains up at multiple thousands of feet. Just because, again, they can do it. They're available. It's also good training, but it's very helpful. And I would argue that's also probably some level of not necessarily diplomacy, but it's creating goodwill. It's still, doing something useful because they're around for that. And that, of course, again, not really what those were expressly designed to resource to do, but they can do it. And mostly there's no other agency that has that capability. The book has examples of this, Navy bases, which house refugees. And again, that the time mentioned in the book here goes back to the 1990s, or refugees from Haiti and Cuba. But of course, that was used in there were bases used to house refugees coming back from Afghanistan in 2021 there. So anyway, it's still happening. The two chapters of the book that really deal with this a lot are the deal with how the United States and the British Royal Navy aircraft carriers transported refugees and returning troops and even what they called war brides from overseas back to their home after World War II. And a lot of people, I think, just see an aircraft carrier as being a very, having one function there, very specific, very important, but a specific function. But using them essentially as transports for this sort of thing was something I think a lot of people don't know about. And it's not, again, not a new function. This goes back nearly 80 years.
And just to move on a little bit from emergencies and to something which is more routine, and of course, this is not so much in the United States today because the United States, has a very developed industrial complex already. But in some other countries, and in the book there is discussion of this happening in Nigeria, And it was also prominent in some countries in you know, in the past. For example, you know, in 18th century Russia, this was a big thing, where the Navy is a driver of socioeconomic change. You know, sometimes if there's a shortage of skilled professionals, then the Navy will take on the role of training them directly or subsidizing their training, either to build the ships or sometimes to serve on the ships. And, you know, sometimes if there is known, for example, in, you know, in Israel, we, our shipbuilding industry currently is receiving assistance from the Navy because we want to build better shipyards to build certain ships which the Navy wants. And so, you have all these ways in which sometimes the Navy can, you know, be the driver of socioeconomic change in the country. And so can you maybe tell us a little bit more about navies and their role in national development?
Sure. And there is, as you mentioned, there's a few places in the book to talk about that. The one that talks almost specifically about that is a great chapter on Nigeria, about how just post-independence, so many facets of national life there early in post-independence period were impacted by their new navy, everything from trades to sporting events, and how also, there's he mentions, you know, it's not all just sugarcoating how much the Navy helped out there. It also talks about there were issues with corruption and with people not wanting the Navy, you know, favoring certain companies, that sort of thing. But how still they did a lot of things, I guess, on a small d, diplomacy. He calls it corporate social responsibility, the same things companies do now to win the goodwill of the communities, which weren't necessarily always a fan of the Navy coming in. And that's, I think, been true in most places. It's a, you know, a large Navy presence can be a, is a, be an economic driver, but also there's probably some challenges that are going to happen there. In the book, on a smaller community level, you've got a really great essay on how the city of Groton, Connecticut, here in the U.S., was shaped by the U.S. Navy presence there, in particular the submarine force, which is at the time was fairly new, and that's been going on again since for most of the last century, and still very much Groton is still kind of the submarine town here in the U.S., still where most submariners go for their training. Also mentioned essay on a proposal for a naval station in Central America that goes back from the early 1800s, pre-Panama Canal, that a U.S. businessman and kind of entrepreneur put forward. It was never really realized, but the story is insightful into how the U.S. in that period, before even the Spanish-American War, so many U.S. citizens and politicians were essentially trying to, hoping to make us an empire there, and then sort of spread that, what you're talking about, spreading national development beyond our shores. And also then to bring it back to very recent times, I mean, we, I guess, like Israel, and again, much more familiar with America's Navy and shipbuilding, or the U.S. Navy shipbuilding here, that not having enough skilled workers to build ships is an issue here. And there's also lots of training programs, apprenticeships that you don't find as much in the civilian world now to bring up our industrial base. So people, we still have the sort of the skilled trades and craftsmen to build ships. And a lot of that is still being driven by the Navy here. So that's also something that's been going for a long time, as mentioned in the book, but is still definitely ongoing in the U.S. where everybody still has sort of challenges with that. And the navies are still sort of jumping in to help out with that.
So it's an ongoing process. It's not something which just happened at some point in history. It's even for the United States, an ongoing process even now.
Yes, it's not like, cool, we got that done, now let's move on. So yeah, it's still an ongoing process. And even if you did, for instance, in, you know, training up folks in World War II to build the ships we had there, that was a huge deal. But then. Those are often, you know, the ship after the wars, shipbuilding often, you know, becomes less of a thing, and you lose those skills. You don't have that corporate knowledge over time. So keeping that going, and that is something that I think our Navy here does.
And for just, you know, there is the other role of a Navy is where it is, you know, has a sort of police function. And it's not really new because it's always existed to some extent. You know, in graduate school, I learned about how the Royal Navy, you know, dealt with tea smuggling into the British Isles. Of course, the 19th century there were the anti-slavery squadrons. And so there's always been, and of course in the United States, one of the purposes of the gunboat fleet was to serve as customs collectors. And so there was always, this always existed to some extent, but recently, you know, as the book explains, there has been the emergence of the Navy in the anti-drug role, which is very much returning to the anti-smuggling activities which navies used to have. And of course, in some countries, to some extent, the Navy also deals with environmental protection, and sometimes it serves as a regulating body as well in terms of safety on ships. And so, in the United States, technically, the Coast Guard is not part of the Navy, but it's also a naval force of a sort, and it also acts as a regulator.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Navies are also, very recently there was a prominent incident in the Pacific with a diving boat fire, which was investigated by the Coast Guard.
And so
naval forces are now acting as police and regulators. And I'd like to ask, to what extent do you think this is like a new phenomenon, and to what extent do you think this is just an extension of what we've seen in the past?
Sure. I think it's probably, as the book points out there, it's definitely an extension of the past. It's people who think it's new or just because what they know about navies comes from, you know, like we said, sort of the grand battles, if they're familiar with the Battle of Midway or Jutland or something from that, you know, Tsushima Straits. That's what they think navies do, but it's a very old process. Although the U.S. Navy traces its foundation back to 1775, a lot of people don't know, it actually, all the ships were sold off, and it was pretty much by the mid-1880s, or 1780s rather, there wasn't really U.S. Navy. When Alexander Hamilton, who was the Treasury Secretary here, decided to start up what he called a fleet of cutters or the Revenue Marine in 1790, based on the British Customs Service, seagoing Customs Service there, to enforce laws and stop smuggling. So if you had no, when a country was pretty much brand new, you couldn't really project power or control the seas very far away. But law enforcement was, I look at that as being law enforcement being sort of the first thing you needed to do as a fairly new country. And you see that mentioned kind of in the one on Nigeria. I think also it just can come about because there's really no other government agency for most countries with the capabilities to do those things. Sean Andrews' essay on the Royal Australian Navy's role in fisheries, and he's actually a captain in the Navy, so he should know these things. He writes an essay on that RAND's fisheries patrols. It gives that mission as a very old one, again, going back to, you know, when Australia's Navy the first sort of becomes its own, separated from Britain. And even that's something they're all still doing there, of course. And on a side note, his subtitle is my favorite in the book, which is Hook, Line, and Sinker. We also have Walker Mills has an essay on the role, particularly in the 1980s and 90s, of the U.S. Navy's involvement in counter-drug operations, which, of course, is usually something you think of as a Coast Guard and Customs mission. And that suggests that this was done in part to show Navy contemporary relevance to post-Cold War security environment. You know, once it said the Navy had sort of control of the seas against other nation states, they just needed something to... You know, you needed to make sure they were still of relevance, and that was definitely a security concern then as it is now, was drug smuggling. It's not explored in the book, but the U.S. Navy also has a history in fisheries patrol. One of the panelists from the McMillan panel we had actually was Blake Thomas Earle, gave a presentation, and he just published a really great book called The Liberty to Take Fish, and that deals with this, the earlier American Republic, the Navy's issues in the Atlantic, trying to make sure that a U.S. fisherman could have access to that. So I think, again, like humanitarian, all the humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, to some level, diplomacy, helping build up the communities they're around for as a economic industrial base. This is something that some people see as a new mission, but it's really old and, again, far more prevalent, I think, than the again, than the big Navy operations that a lot of people think is what the navies are mostly do.
Yeah, yes, and you know, Walker is a very, you know, is a very insightful writer, and we've had him on this show before.
Oh, sure, and he writes more than I think he publishes more essays than I write emails. The guy's incredibly prolific.
But I would just like to push back a little bit about something in the book, in the discussion of counter-narcotics operations. And again, according to what, you know, what that chapter in the book says, just, it says, you know, okay, we've done all of this, all of these operations, we've deployed the Navy to stop the cocaine, we've intercepted this and this many of these cocaine boats, we've captured so many tons of cocaine, but it's not really, you know, but the amount of the stuff which is getting into America's streets hasn't declined. We, again, according to the book. And so, I'm thinking as I look at this, you know, okay, so what is, you know, if we've done all of this counter-smuggling activity, but there hasn't been, you know, we haven't stopped the smuggling, yes? So, is it really, now, had America been an island, you know, like Britain is, of course, a series of islands, Australia is an island, so maybe on an island country that's more important, but I just like to question a little bit this counter-smuggling role in the context of big countries, which, you know, which have land borders like the United States. What's going on here?
Sure, yeah. I won't necessarily take issue with the fact, you know, the questioning of its, I guess, relevance there. Again, part of the book's like to explore, and if it's, these are some things other navies have done, and if in fact they didn't end up being that successful, that's also, you know, it's worthy of exploring. What it suggests, I guess, and I guess what reality, it, what the effort obviously wasn't wholly successful. Drug wars have been going on for many decades, and I think the question of what winning looks like is still unanswered. I mean, it's unlike a battle where there's obviously one person in charge of the field or who has, you know, command of the local sea area there. This is a law enforcement, and so you're, despite saying winning the, you know, the war on crime or whatever, that's not probably not going to happen. That role, the counter-smuggling, counter-drug op, is obviously certainly not what the U.S. Navy says are its most important roles today, and I don't, probably didn't even say it was the most important then. But I think, like many of the non-traditional missions mentioned in the book, even if it didn't completely succeed or result in some sort of resolution of the issue at hand, there were likely collateral benefits that came from that. Maybe within the Navy, you're learning new tactics, getting more experience with interagency work. That's certainly a thing. Maybe just keeping funding and training going on until something, you know, a real world during a period of decreased need for, again, for the primary missions. Similarly to that, I think, the role the U.S. Coast Guard played, which, of course, is usually the counter-smuggling one, the role mentioned in the book, what they played in what would be considered more traditional U.S. Navy roles during the early years of Operation Iraqi Freedom. They used their law enforcement and basic aids to navigation roles, which they've, you know, do in peacetime there. They were able to use those and apply those to a wartime contested environment. Even while they were, the Coast Guard can go under the U.S. Navy during times of war, even though they didn't, as a complete service during this one, go under the U.S. Navy, they still were working with them and able to apply some of those roles. So I like to think there was some sort of, you know, ideally a positive cross-contamination. Everybody learned a little bit from each other, even if the stated objectives perhaps weren't realized as much as folks would have liked.
I edited this book, and I think that, you know, if you've edited a book on the subject, this makes you an expert. It's sort of, you know, expert badge, yes?
Sure, okay, I guess so. I know, yeah, close enough.
And, you know, so I'd like to ask you, where are we sailing? You know, in terms of, you've talked about the different roles of navies and how they evolve, and do you think that we're, what are we going to see in terms of the evolution of naval roles in the near future?
All right. I appreciate the expert thing. I put together a lot of content from really great experts here. And if I am one, it's just because I read their stuff. I learned an amazing amount from reading all the stuff here. But I'll go back to the book on that question. I think, pardon me, we're seeing some evolution of operations discussed in the book. I mean, we've got a piece about the British Royal Navy's role in the origins of strategic bombing during World War I, which they actually saw as an extension of the blockade at the time of land-based aircraft piloted by Royal Navy folks bombing Germany. They saw that as an extension of the blockade. We don't necessarily think of strategic air power as a blockading, you know, force, but that's how they saw it, not really as power projection. So that's way before we have aircraft carriers, of course. But I'll say, like, now in Ukraine, you've seen levels of sea control practiced in the Black Sea without having an actual Navy or a float platform to do that. Of course, in the Red Sea and from Yemen, you're seeing naval forces are striking arguably strategically inland forces. Again, not really something surprising in 2024, but it was revolutionary, 110 years ago. And that, of course, is still evolving, still seeing how the concepts that the non-traditional roles of navies were able to be used to maybe still bring about the general thing that navies were supposed to, we think navies are doing, but perhaps their platformed and assets aren't being used the way we necessarily think they should be. While the majority of the book is focused on history, the final essay from Jimmy Drennan is called Beyond Navies and Beyond Defense, The Case for a United States Maritime Department. And this one definitely looks to the future for the most part. I mean, he used a lot of historical case studies, but he's looking to the future there. He makes the case for what he believes is a preferable future for the U.S., where you would have rather than a variety of agencies managing, overseeing the various seagoing aspects of America, we would have a more combined department in there, because we have a maritime department, we have a transportation department, or maritime administration, transportation department, Department of Homeland Security, which has the Coast Guard under it and customs under it, of course, the Department of Navy, but they're not always aligned, he argues there. So that was his, this again came out, he wrote that a few years ago, but just late last year, the Secretary of the Navy in the U.S. gave a speech calling for what he called a new maritime statecraft. And he quote, in a broad sense, this encompasses not only naval diplomacy, but a national whole of government effort to build comprehensive U.S. and allied maritime power, both commercial and naval. So, you know, it was going forward when the book, this was written in the book, and it is at least being pursued in reality right now. And I recall in the last few months reading that it was questioned why some commentators questioned why the U.S. had aircraft carriers and amphibious ships in the Middle East if it wasn't about to essentially bomb or invade in the Israel, intervene in the Israel-Gaza conflict for some, you know, a more kinetic approach there. And a few navalists knowing more about this jumped into the conversation there to point out that those types of ships and their crews can do a lot of other things, like evacuate civilians, provide medical care, deliver humanitarian supplies. So if your knowledge of naval forces is just something like the Battle of Midway or a landing at Iwo Jima or Okinawa or D-Day, something like that, you may not be aware that these types of ships and the people on them can do a variety of things, and they're still doing those. So I think that's helpful to be aware of. And again, part of the book here was to get these other means into the conversation, at least to provide a more accurate picture of how naval forces are and can be used. And lastly, of course, as we say in the book's intro, these various non-traditional roles, I guess I've probably said this too much here, but they're not really new at all. And as long as naval forces have these capabilities, which are unavailable to other organizations or agencies, and needs or crisis arise, and the naval forces can meet those, even if not perfectly, at least better than the other options, then I'd expect they'll continue in the future.
And this brings us, you know, as I mentioned, we are creatures of tradition. I mentioned this before. You know, if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof.
One of my favorite movies, in fact.
you know, Rev Tevye explains about explains the importance of tradition. So do I. And I'd like to conclude our show also with a traditional question. And as I've, as we started out, this is a, we are after all the New Books Network. The books are right there in the title. And I'd like to ask you, what are you reading right now? Is there some book which you would like to tell us about?
Oh, sure.
Where are you in your book journey?
Sounds good. I've got a few, but first I will have the opening song in Fiddler stuck in my head the rest of the day, and that's not so bad. It's a great song. I can do a mean Tevye alone by myself. So I'll start out with the panelists from the McMullen Naval History Panel that I talked about putting together back in 2021. They've all had books on their topics come out since then, and I've got a. One of the moderator from that panel had a book come out just before, so I'm going to recommend those for some extra concepts on sea power by other means. So, you know, hopefully you read this book, but here's a few I've just read recently that are all on a similar topic if you found this interesting to our listeners. Dr. Mike Verney, he wrote a book called A Great and Rising Nation, which is about early U.S. Navy exploring expeditions, including one to the Middle East there. It went to what's now Israel there. Also exploring in Antarctica, exploring on the U.S. West Coast back in the early American Republic. So really good book there. Good for an academic. These are all, I would say, good for academics and also just for the casual reader who wants to learn more. Dr. Jason Smith, who was our moderator there, he wrote To Master the Boundless Sea, the U.S. Navy, the Marine Environment, and the Cartography of Empire, and goes into some of the early science that was developed by the U.S. Navy. And again, I apologize, most of these are kind of U.S.-centric. But how the U.S. Navy developed into things like early sciences there, cartography, oceanography, that sort of thing. Really interesting. Dr. Will Murray wrote a book called Newsrooms and the Disruptions of the Internet, A Short History of Disruptive Technologies from 1990 to 2010. Will did a... He is a... media comes from like a media historian background, but he was also a Navy reservist. So he mixes those a lot. He did a great paper for the panel on the U.S. Navy's pioneering use of shipboard movies in the 1930s. Again, definitely not something that was probably the one that fell farthest outside of what people would think sort of navies were set up to do. But he gave a really good argument for the role those played in as the Navy was expanding. And back, I mentioned it earlier, but Blake Thomas, The Freedom to Take Fish, which I mentioned about early 1800s U.S. Navy in the operations in Atlantic, so making sure U.S. fishermen could essentially establishing a kind of, attempting to establish a kind of sea control. So U.S. Navy fishermen, which was very important to the economy then as it is now, could fish in the Atlantic, even though from the small new little country that was America. And then lastly, I'm co-editing a collection called Fighting Surrounded with Tim Heck, and I'm reading a whole lot of essays coming in, really great essays and proposals for this book, which we hope to have out sometime in 2025. So been spending some time with all of those. Thank you.
You're welcome. And once again, of course, when you finish this book, and as you said, next year, you are welcome on our show again. As
I always say, happy to do it.
As I always say, you know, nobody writes just one book. When you finish it, when it's out, you're always welcome here. And
thank you.
Of course, I thank you for being here with us today, Jay.
Thanks so much, Boris. It was a great time. I really appreciate you and all the listeners there. Do good work.